The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The articles in this episode are from BlackEnterprise.com, and the first one is titled, How Usher's My Way Residency Has Made Park MGM Vegas main attraction. Upon entering the city of sin, one may think that Usher's been here for over one calendar year. His likeness is plastered across billboards in the airport, peering across at you from atop taxis, and on the lips of passerbyers, all asking the same question. Are you going to the show? No need to explain. Everyone knows if you're in Vegas, you must be here to see Usher. For Park MGM, it's a marriage made in debonair. Party till you drop, leave your cares behind heaven after a $550 million transformation from the outdated Monte Carlo Resorts in 2019, the 2,900-room behemoth has been the less trendy and more upscale option for travelers looking to experience Vegas with a side of serenity. Contrary to its size, everything about European inspired digs feels like a boutique stay, right down to its smoke-free policy, the first of its kind on the Strip. And with the opening of its Nomad Las Vegas Hotel within a hotel offering, Park MGM has cemented itself as the city's hotel for those who hope to leave Vegas with memories they don't mind sharing. And being the home to Usher's one-of-a-kind residency makes it a place to remember. 10 minutes away from Park MGM's front door is Sammy Davis Jr. Drive, named after the first black person allowed to perform on the Strip, though he wouldn't be able to stay at the El Rancho Motel and Casino where his show was held until many years later. After Davis, Lena Horne, Nat King Cole, and Ella Fitzgerald followed suit. Later, Anna Bailey became the first black showgirl in Vegas history, while black comedians like Richard Pryor and Red Fox would also find a home in the bright lights of the Strip in the late 60s and 70s. However, Usher's popularity has been unparalleled. On to the nostalgia of his heyday. Nor is he at the height of his popularity. It's not a farewell tour or an experience only a day one fan can appreciate. What Usher has been able to do, no doubt what Park MGM expected, is capture at once the soul of black culture and harmoniously pair it with the city's energy. There is an homage to those who came before. He starts the show in a perfectly tailored all-white number that feels plucked off of Davis himself, and an undeniable nod to the era of music that made him a household name. There's an ode to the stripper dominant culture of his hometown, combined with theatrics and staging that rival the thrilling experience of the neighboring Vegas mainstay, Cirque du Soleil. And just when you're ready to get swept up in the spectacular of it all, a single spotlight shines down on Usher, who is alone on stage, having finished a string of ballads that prove his mic is always on. And it's clear that this level of excellence, of mastery, and execution could be achieved by very few other artists. past or present. No, Usher didn't need a Vegas residency, but the city desperately needed him. By the time his 2004 number one single, Yeah, booms through the speakers, the audience has reached a fever pitch, a mixture of knowing the end has come and gratitude at having spent the last 2 hours in the presence of one of music's all-time greats. If your ears are open as the sold-out crowd moves toward the exit, echoes of the words, "Girl, we have to come back," fill the theater's lobby. Yeah, man, the 44-year-old father of four has redefined what it means to blow the roof off of a place and Park MGM's spot in Vegas's history has been firmly cemented as a result. The next article is titled, History Personified. Oldest Living Tulsa Massacre Survivor Publishes Memoir. 109-year-old Viola Ford Fletcher is the oldest living survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. After testifying before Congress to help make a case for reparations and call for accountability for the brutal attack on Black Wall Street in 1921, Fletcher has published a memoir about her life. Don't Let Them Bury My Story, published on Tuesday, July 4th, is an inside look at the life of a woman who carried the brutality of America in her most intimate memories since the age of 7, according to the Associated Press. In graphic detail, Fletcher shares the events of the massacre in hopes of preserving the narrative that was nearly lost due to the refusal of historians to acknowledge the brutal violence that took place right here in the land of the free. The question I had then remained to this day, Fletcher writes in the book. How could you just give a mob of violent, crazed, racist people a bunch of deadly weapons and allow them, no, encourage them to go out and kill innocent Black folks and demolish a whole community? Fletcher and her family were one of the families who managed to make it out of Tulsa, Oklahoma alive. We passed piles of dead bodies heaped in the streets, she writes in the book. Some of them had their eyes open as though they were still alive, but they weren't. Like many survivors of the massacre, Fletcher believed that recognizing what happened would open the door for proper reparations for those affected. However, the city of Tulsa has never sought to compensate its Black community. As a centenarian, Fletcher has lived through some of this country's brightest and darkest days, but now she has lived to see her own historical account light up billboards in New York's Times Square. It is her own way of assuring Black Wall Street is never forgotten. The next article is titled, Wrongfully Convicted Black Man Sues Police Department After Spending 16 Years Incarcerated. Kenneth Nixon, a Black man from Detroit, served a 16-year prison sentence after being found guilty of a murder he did not commit. Now that a Wayne County judge has overturned his conviction, Nixon is suing the city's police department for its life-altering actions. In a lawsuit filed last week, the now 37-year-old accused the Detroit Police Department of framing him and using the falsified testimony of an inmate seeking early release to steal nearly two decades of his life, including time spent away from his two young children. According to the Detroit News, Nixon was accused of throwing a Molotov cocktail into the home of Naomi Vaughn, which resulted in a fire that claimed the lives of two of her children. On the night in question, Nixon was at home with his then-girlfriend, a story many witnesses corroborated during his trial. According to the lawsuit, Vaughn's boyfriend alleged that Nixon started the fire, but his story was inconsistent. Police relied heavily on the statement from Vaughn's 13-year-old son that was deemed inconsistent by one of the chief detectives on the case at the time, according to the Huffington Post. Still, Nixon was found guilty of the murders and sentenced to life in prison without parole. In his lawsuit, he alleges the police used fabricated evidence to help support claims from the teenage boy and Vaughn's boyfriend. In addition, officers used the testimony of a jailhouse informant whose sentence they promised to reduce, who claimed Nixon had confessed to the murders. It would take 16 years for Nixon to be exonerated. The lawsuit seeks to compensate him for the years he wasted behind bars and to hold police departments accountable for problematic practices that often cost black and brown people their futures. The constitutional violations that caused plaintiffs' wrongful conviction were not isolated events, the lawsuit states. To the contrary, they were the result of defendant City of Detroit's long-standing policies and practices of pursuing wrongful convictions through reliance on profoundly flawed investigations and fabricated informant testimony. Detroit police have a long history of using the testimony of jailhouse snitches without any regard to the accuracy of their statements. The next article is titled, Bishop William J. Barber II delivers his last sermon after announcing his retirement. Bishop William J. Barber II, pastor and civil rights leader, is passing the mantle after 30 years. Barber announced his retirement as the senior pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, because of arthritis. According to CNN, Barber has a form of arthritis that causes inflammation in the spine and can affect posture and breathing, per the Mayo Clinic. Church and state are both responsible for advancing black people in America for the civil rights activist. Barber spoke to the nation when he was appointed to deliver the sermon at President Joe Biden's inaugural prayer service at Washington National Cathedral. The retired pastor proclaimed, "We cannot accept the racial disparities, violence, and preaches that impact black, brown, Native, and Asian Americans while offering collateral damage to our poor white brothers and sisters and ultimately our entire democracy," according to Time magazine. The work Barber has done speaks for him. He became the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP in 2005 and remained in the position for 12 years. Per CNN, Barber was known for his nonviolent approach to challenging legislation he disagreed with, like his Moral Monday protest. In April 2023, ABC 11 reported Barber had led the protest against discriminatory laws and policies for 10 years. According to CNN, Barber is the founding director of the Yale Center for Public Theology and Public Policy. The outlet reported that he will continue his work there. Black Enterprise previously reported Barber said his goal was to share his knowledge with a new generation of moral leaders. Barber said of his role as head of the center at the time, "We will teach this history and engage divinity students, law students, and undergrads in moral fusion, analysis, articulation, and activism in the tradition of Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, Walter and Howard Thurman, Ida B. Wells, Dorothy Day, MLK, and Ella Baker." Barber has held the spiritual office of senior pastor of Greenleaf Christian Church since 1993. The next article is titled, "Nonprofit Recruits Black Male Educators to Boost Men's Presence and Leadership in the School System." A little over 1% of educators in the nation are black men. As part of Fox 17's Path Forward initiative, the television station examined the statistics of black men leading in the education space and how organizations such as the Black Male Educators Alliance are working to recruit more black men to take on leadership roles in schools and classrooms. BMEA was founded in 2017 by Curtis Lewis, Ph.D., to transform the education experience for black and brown students by developing culturally responsive educators dedicated to the growth of the youth. BMEA's initial target is to increase the number of black males in Michigan classrooms, and it has expanded to creating culturally sustaining policies, structured programming, and teacher pedagogy. The nonprofit's programs include school partnerships, leadership events, and wellness sessions for teachers and principals. "We are trying to create this pipeline. We also try to keep those who are already in the profession there as well," Lewis said, noting that the way to diversify the profession is by changing the way things are done. Seventh and eighth grade science teacher William Childers is the only black man teaching at Riverside Middle School in Grand Rapids, and he said people think it is uncommon to see someone like him working as an educator in STEM. Their parents are appreciative of Childers being an example for his students. "They just don't see too many things, and that's part of the cultural and equity part. A lot of them just see basketball and football players," Childers said. "Does it make me do my job differently? No, because I am just trying to affect the students that I have." According to Jason McGee, Ed D., a black principal at Innovation Central High School, "Representation is important. We have about 52% of our student population are Spanish-speaking, Latino, Latina. About 38% are Black. So, for those high numbers, especially those Black boys and girls, I am their principal, McGee said. I don't have any Black male educators in the building, but I do have Black male support staff. My assistant principal is a Black man. I have youth advocates and a college advisor who is a Black man. The next article is titled, Diverse Sperm Shortage Raises Concerns for Black Women, Leads Woman to Open First Black-Owned Cryo Bank in the Country. Have a child that doesn't reflect your race or don't have a baby. These are the options for Black women these days. Black women are facing difficulties finding sperm donors who share their backgrounds. After a limited choice in her own process of finding a sperm donor, Angela is ready to open the first Black-owned cryo bank in the country. According to CBS News, after looking into the four major U.S. cryo banks, which include California Cryo Bank, Fairfax Cryo Bank, Seattle Sperm Bank, and Zytex, it was found that less than 4% of available sperm is from Black donors. Dr. Tia Jackson Bay, a fertility doctor in New York City, confirmed the struggle through the experience of her own patients of color. Historically, donors have been recruited from places where maybe Black men are not present, you know, institutions of higher learning, certain areas, geographic areas in the country, Jackson Bay said. Reportedly, most cryo banks require something not all Black Americans have access to, three generations of medical family history. With the diversity shortage, Angela, who identifies as half Black and half Croatian, had to fall back on her non-negotiable to have a Black baby and choose to welcome a multiracial child with her wife. It's America. We are supposed to have all the choices that we want, but we really don't have any choices in this process. And this is the one process that really impacts our legacy, the rest of our lives, you know, our future as a family and as a people, Angela said. Her cryo bank reproductive village will mark history when it opens in Washington, D.C. Its focus will surround recruiting Black donors and providing drop-off locations in cities such as Houston and Atlanta. I want to give them access to the same amount of options that every other couple has going through this process, Angela said. The Seattle Sperm Bank and California Cryo Bank, two of the largest cryo banks, claim they are also committed to addressing the shortage through research and recruitment. The Seattle Sperm Bank said it would be working to actively recruit more men of color, spreading the word about the importance of sperm donation. The sperm bank hopes the conversations will break the taboo surrounding this type of donation and get the word out about the increasing need for more donors. TV's funny new quote-unquote it man, Kalen Allen, is on a mission to spread joy. Whether you see him on your phone or television screen, Kalen Allen will surely lift your spirits. Kalen Allen's name has become synonymous with laughter, from his humorous Instagram stories to his famous food reactions. Allen, however, isn't just a digital content creator. He is also television's hilarious new quote unquote it man. And he's on a mission to spread joy to all of our lives. At just 27 years old, he is already an award-winning actor, producer, singer, and television personality, discovered by Ellen DeGeneres from one of his viral food reaction YouTube videos. Alan's infectious personality quickly took over our screens, from YouTube, The Ellen DeGeneres Show, and hosting red carpets, to joining the Food Network team, dropping a Christmas EP, and an upcoming role in the Netflix rom-com Meet Me Next Christmas. Alan is undeniably taking the entertainment world by storm. The start of Kalen Allen's journey. Alan shared that the theater kid in him loves to do anything that's in front of an audience. I'm so used to having an audience, and that's where I feed energy from. Luckily for him, his mom has always supported his journey. He believes one of the reasons he has made it to where he is today is because he was never forced to have a plan B. I think when you have people around you that believe in you and always tell you that you're going to be great, you start to believe that yourself. When you have that foundational support, the world is your oyster. And while people have doubted him along the way, he has never let that stop him, stating, "I always use underestimation as my motivation." Alan has a strong sense of self and trusts his journey every step of the way. "I have a theory in my life that I am divinely guided," Alan shared. The success of his first YouTube video was unexpected and a bit of an accident. He reacted to someone making cornbread that popped up as a sponsored ad. "Something in my spirit just told me at that time to make a video about it." He set up his phone, hit record, and that first video went viral. Following his gut, he made more content similar to the first. The first video was created in November 2017. By December 2017, he was already taping his first episode for Ellen DeGeneres. By January 2018, he was moving to LA. Things have not slowed down for Ellen since. What he is up to today? Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.